Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Kopi Dulu means coffee first in Indonesian, a common phrase from those who are happy to have coffee anywhere, anytime, and with anyone. At least, that was Mark Evely's experience as a travel writer and reporter traveling across the country's many islands. That phrase gives the title of his latest book, Kopi Dulu, Caffeine-Fueled Travels Through Indonesia, published by Penguin Southeast Asia. Mark travels through Indonesia's cities and villages, jungles and seas, sharing his experience with the country's nature, history, and possibility for adventure. Mark is a travel writer and photographer whose work has, over 25 years, graced the pages of some of the world's most prestigious travel titles. The British-born writer, who lived most of his first decade in West Africa, has traveled widely in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, working for some of the world's most prestigious publications, including the BBC, The Telegraph, The Guardian, The Independent, National Geographic Traveler, Condé Nast Traveler, and CNN. Today, Mark joins the show to share his stories on islands like Java, Sumatra, and Borneo, and why it's important to pay attention to this large Southeast Asian country. So, Mark, thanks for coming on the show today. You know, I want to start by asking about the title of your book, which uses the phrase Kopi Dulu. You know, what exactly does that phrase mean, and why do you want to give your book that title?
Well, Kopi Dulu basically means coffee first in Indonesian. And from the very earliest days when I started traveling in Indonesia about 25, 26 years ago, Kopi Dulu started to feel to me, it had an essence of Indonesia's hospitality, code of hospitality here. No matter where I landed, in a city or a town or even a little jungle camp, people would often, you know, almost after you've introduced yourself, sit down, let's have a kopi. Kopi Dulu, we'll have a chat and settle in. And as I traveled more and more around Indonesia, it became kind of a Indonesian catchphrase for hospitality here. Some people have jumped to the conclusion it's actually a book about coffee, but it's a travel book from Indonesia, and I guess it's really a book about hospitality and the local cultures here and meeting local people.
So, I mean, let's talk about kind of meeting local people. You know, how much of Indonesia and how many of these communities did you get to see during your travels there? And that kind of leads to my other question, which is, and what was it about those experiences that drove you to write this book in the first place?
Well, you know, the scale of Indonesia, even after I've done quite a lot of traveling around the country, even after all of that, the scale of Indonesia just really blows my mind. You know, it's if you traveled from, let's say, from Aceh in the far west to Papua in the far east, it would be like doing a road trip from London to Khartoum, Sudan. And probably culturally, the differences across those areas is comparable with that as well. I couldn't write about everywhere I've been in Indonesia in this book, and I narrowed it down. All the same, this trip follows a route of about, give or take, 15,000 kilometers around Indonesia, and takes in the 50, more or less 50 of the most exciting islands and the most unique cultures that I've come across. And I wanted to write the book because I really, I kind of started in the introduction to the book, you know, that Indonesia is sometimes described as the world's most invisible country. And that's not meant to sound insulting. And for anybody in Southeast Asia, it's extremely well known. But it's incredible that the world's fourth most populous country, you know, most people in the West wouldn't have the slightest idea how to find Indonesia on a map. And apart from Bali, you know, people... Sometimes, you know, people in the West consider that Bali is Indonesia. They really overlook the fact that there's so much incredible diversity on a nature front, on a cultural front, landscapes, even, you know, fascinating cities. It's so diverse here. And I really, you know, I'd been surprised that there really isn't a book that I have thought that really does justice to to that incredible diversity. And that was really why I wanted to get Kopi Dulu written. Why it's a book that's been in my mind to write for 15 years, probably.
So let's talk about that diversity a bit. I mean, as you said, like everyone knows Bali. Bali is kind of the tourist hotspot. Everyone knows about that island. People probably know about Java, given it's where some like major cities like Jakarta are. But there are, of course, all these other islands in the country, even pretty big, prominent ones like Sulawesi still don't get a lot of attention. What do we miss by ignoring these islands that aren't Bali, that aren't Java?
Yeah. As I've traveled around, I've got, it's difficult to pigeonhole these islands because they're so different, so unique. Even neighboring islands can be wildly different. But it seems to me, I've started to think that you have the Western islands, you have the big Western islands that tend to be better more well known. There's Bali, which is obviously tiny, but then you have Java, you have Sumatra. They both get a fair amount of tourism. And then as you come across towards, let's say, the middle of Indonesia, you start to get Flores and Sumba. Then you get Kalimantan. You get Flores, Sumba, Sulawesi, Kalimantan. I mean, Kalimantan is two-thirds of the world's third biggest island, two-thirds of the island of Borneo. And that's such incredible potential for adventure there. I've just spent the last 6 weeks traveling around it, actually. I've traveled about 5,000 kilometers around Kalimantan in the last 6 weeks, researching for another book. And, I actually bumped into 10 travelers here. It's amazing how few people get to these incredible areas. And then as you go even further east, you have the Maluku's, the little Maluku Islands. Well, I say little. I mean, Halmahera Island there is, the name would probably not even be familiar to a lot of Indonesians. And yet that's an incredible island that has that's three times the size of Bali, still pretty much covered in jungle, incredible cultures, spectacular volcanic landscapes, three times the size of Bali, and most people wouldn't have the slightest idea where it is. I love those islands over there, but as you get over that side, it becomes more inaccessible. It's actually a lot harder to get to. Especially for anybody who doesn't speak Indonesian. I mean, I can scrabble by an Indonesian after the traveling I've done here. And those little islands, it's just a whole world waiting to be explored. People say the accepted statistics, although nobody really knows how many islands there are in Indonesia, the accepted statistic is somewhere between 13,500 and 17,500. And most estimates agree that there are probably 12,000 uninhabited islands. I mean, there's not another country in the world that has that kind of potential for adventure.
So you mentioned in one of your answers earlier that, that you want to write about the hospitality that you kind of came across from ordinary Indonesians as you were traveling around all these different islands. And I expect for many of these communities, you might have been the only foreigner they might have ever met, or the first foreigner to have been there in a very, very, very long time. I wonder if you might kind of talk about what it was like to kind of meet these people, to meet these households, these store owners, these guides, and I guess about the hospitality they showed you as someone who was visiting.
One of the highlights really of the trips has been in cases where I've been able to go back to places sometimes mm. several years after I first visited them, and to meet people. There have been villages where I've been the first Westerner who's been there, in West Kalimantan, for example. And recently I've just been back to visit them for the fourth time. And it's so nice to go back to those villages. But your question brings to mind something that I've been noticing lately, and it's a strange kind of post-pandemic change in the cultures, in that a lot of those places in the last couple of years, have now received TV, they have phone signals, they have YouTube. And so it's so strange that even within the last couple of weeks, I've met little kids, maybe, 3-4 years old, who will certainly never have seen an outsider before, never have seen a Westerner, and probably not a tourist even from the region. And yet suddenly, far different from how it was 20 years ago when I traveled here, you know, we're familiar from TV, from YouTube. And there was even a little girl I met the other day who's like 4 years old in a village way up the Mahakam River. And she has an amazing command of English. Okay, only a four-year-old command of English, but it's quite incredible that she's reeling off all these names of animals and colors and things. And she gets it purely from YouTube, you know, so that the world is kind of changing in that way.
You know, one of the kind of stories that most jumped out to me kind of in reading your book was your time spent on the, and I'm going to probably pronounce this word incorrectly, on the Finnissy, which are these boats. Sounds like a very fancy boat, but, you know, made entirely from wood, I believe, and made using traditional techniques. I wonder if you might talk a bit more about these shipbuilders and about this traditional art of building these vessels.
Yeah, sure. When I mentioned earlier about the Maluku's and all of that little tangle of island, well, huge tangle of islands actually, but you know, so remote and fairly inaccessible. They're really inaccessible almost in any other way. You could get there on little fishing boats if you had a command of the language, but basically Panisis are an amazing way for exploring even the remotest islands in eastern Indonesia. And they're able to do it in a level of very high luxury, actually. As you pointed out, you know, some of these boats are extremely luxurious, but not all Panisis are like that. And many of them are still working boats. Although these days, Panisis going under sail is very, very, very unusual, except in the tourism market where they're still built along kind of traditional lines, but with engines. And but one of the really amazing things about them, the cultural side of everything, they're built by the Bugis people. And now the Bugis are the people, they used to be pirates who plundered across chasing the monsoon winds. Traders, some might say, in a lot of cases, they were definitely pirates. And the word boogeyman came to, you know, a million childhood nightmares from the Bugis people. And their communities are on the southern side of Sulawesi. And they still continue to build these boats to ancient traditions. There's they don't need you know, blueprints and drawings, basically a boat etched out on the sand, and they can build a 50-60 meter Panisi. Traditionally, these days they're building a lot more for the tourism market. And now, thankfully, let's say, Indonesia has stopped a lot of the logging, so the hardwoods that they used to get are now much shorter supply. So it's difficult for them for that reason, but that, you know, in the long run, that's a good thing. But the traditions they're still built along the same traditional lines and involving a lot of ceremonies. One of the things that sticks in my mind, for example, is that in the old days they used to say that a boat had to take 9 months for it to be built. And this is what I was told when I was there. And that's because a boat has to come alive. It's just like a person. It's a living thing. And at the beginning, when they lay the keel, for example, they chop the end of the keel off and throw it into the water. It's almost the first thing they do. So now that the ocean has 9 months to get used to the boat before it's launched, obviously there are a lot of sacrifices and things involved all the way along the process. It's an amazing tradition. And these, you know, Western marine architects who have been there to work with the Bugis people have usually come away learning way more from the Bugis than the Bugis learned from the Westerners. I don't think anybody knows how old the tradition is. It's probably one of those seafaring traditions that's evolved over centuries, you know, if not a thousand years, maybe. And it's evolved. So, you know, there's no point where you say this is when they started building Panisis. But it's recently been recognized as a UNESCO part of the intangible heritage. So a little bit more notice is going that way. But I was very privileged to go and spend time in those communities, learning a little bit how the boats are actually built and then sailed.
I remember reading the bit about how a boat takes 9 months to build, regardless of how big it is.
So it's not like when they're building a smaller boat, they build it in less time. It's like, no, it takes 9 months, and that's how long it takes.
Exactly. It's they would, you know, a small boat, the way they explained it to me, a small boat, you maybe will build it with just five people and it will take you 9 months. A big boat is going to take, 100 people to build it, and it'll still take 9 months. This is the tradition. But these days, I mean, a boat that I was sailing on, is a multi-million dollar, has been tuned basically to a super yacht, and that took 7 years. So it's not a tradition that's cast in iron these days, huh?
I want to shift topics now. You know, the name Wallace pops up a lot in your book, and that's referring to the famous biologist. But I guess, you know, who was he, and what makes him so important when it comes to talking about Indonesia?
Yeah. Alfred Russel Wallace. Well, he was a Welsh naturalist. Firstly, he's since I started reading about Indonesia, he's pretty much my hero. Actually, he's an amazing character. He's the poor guy. Basically, has gone down in history as the man who wasn't Darwin. He came up with the theory of evolution on the island of Ternate in the Maluku's, and wrote a letter to Darwin while he himself, Wallace, was still there collecting species. He was a naturalist who collected species for sales. And Darwin was inspired, or let's say provoked by that idea, to release his own theory of evolution. And some historians have built up, you know, that there was a kind of a rift and, arguments between them, but I don't think so. I think it seems like they were mutually very respectful, and it's just strange that they came up with the same theory at basically the same time. But what inspires me about Darwin, about Wallace, is his book. He wrote the Malay Archipelago about his 6 years of travels around those islands, and I still think it's the most exciting book by any Westerner on Indonesia. It's such an exciting book to read. People sometimes say, they couldn't get through it. It was boring. But I usually think that if they say that, they probably didn't actually try to read it, because it's a great book. And apart from his great descriptions of the natural world and everything, he was just such an adventurer and really a hero. And he traveled. He Darwin was quite a gentleman with his place on the Beagle. Wallace traveled in very much grassroots conditions. He really roughed it. He didn't mind sleeping in jungle huts. I think he was 6'6" or something, and he used to sleep in jungle huts with his boots sticking out of the doors. And he traveled always with local people. This was pre-Indonesian, obviously, but he obviously they were friends. He had a great relationship with those people. It was really not like the typical explorer of his era. And then the findings, you know, the stuff that he discovered. Off the top of my head, I think it's 125,000 species he brought back, and I think 3,000 or 5,000 were new to science. So it was amazing what he managed to achieve in those travels.
And he comes up with something called the Wallace line, which again kind of gets a few references in your book. What exactly is this line?
Yeah, the Wallace line is a division that cuts down through Indonesia between Borneo and Sulawesi, and between Lombok and Bali. I mean, you can basically see the currents. It's not a visible line, but if you look across the sea from Bali towards Lombok, there's almost a rift where the currents actually shoot through, and they're so vicious that they have basically stopped a lot of species from crossing between east and west. So either what it basically means is either side of the Wallace line, and Wallace was the first person to realize that, you have a different set of species. You have marsupials on one side, monkeys on the other side. That kind of thing. He found the island where he realized must be the most easterly spot where monkeys had ever been. And what's more, he realized that it was probably Bugis sailors who had released pets there that brought that population there, because he was well aware that they were on an island where they shouldn't have been. I think the line was named the Wallace line. As far as I know, it was named well after his death. He was probably not even aware he got attributed as that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, I guess one more question on Wallace. I'm just remembering, and I forget exactly what Indonesian city you were in, but you spend time trying to find his house, and you actually find a building that's probably where Wallace may have stayed.
Yeah, that was in Ternate, so where he wrote the letter to Darwin. And he spent several months in Ternate, or he used it as a base anyway, and would go in and out from there. Actually down to a little island called Bacan, which I really want to get back to and explore. I stopped in it researching for the book, but that's an amazing little area. And it's about a third the size of Bali. And I don't think that any other Westerner had been in the villages that we landed in the north, perhaps even since Wallace was there. I couldn't say for sure, but nobody there had ever seen a Westerner arrive, put it that way. And yeah, we went to look for his house in Ternate. People have tried to find it, but there were a couple of houses that had been listed, you know, and there's even a Wallace Avenue, a Wallace alleyway, which seemed like a great place to start. But the probable houses that we found were clearly not the right one. And it didn't take a ton of detective work, actually, because Alfred Russel Wallace was so thorough in pretty much everything he did that he actually drew a floor plan of the house in his book, in the Malay Archipelago. So I managed to figure out basically the size that Ternate might have been at that time, and his descriptions of walking between the port and the little marketplace, and the fact that there were no other Westerners living beyond, because in those days that village would have been, it was actually the Dutch capital in those days. So he would have known pretty much, you know, there will have been Westerners living there. So we managed to track the house down and realized that there was really only one that could fit with the floor plan that he described. And people, as I said at the beginning of our talk, actually, are so hospitable. There was actually a kids' party going on there. And I can't imagine how in England you could basically wander as a complete stranger up to a kids' birthday party and be invited in. But that's what happens in Indonesia. And they invited us in, and we kind of shyly explained what we were looking for. And they led us out the back of the house, and there was the well in exactly the position that Wallace had described it. So I'm 99% sure that that was the house that we found.
You know, I want to stay on the topic of nature and biodiversity and you know, I guess all of that biodiversity in Indonesia, but I guess returning to the present day and your own travels throughout the country. I mean, you get to experience all this nature for yourself. I mean, you're also roughing it in the jungle. Nature intrudes on your travels a lot. You go to the place, the island where the Komodo dragons are from, and I guess maybe just kind of cap off our conversation about your travel to the country. I just want to ask you about your experiences with Indonesia's nature, with all of its animal and plant diversity.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to harp on about statistics and things, but even on this basis, it's the second most diverse country on the planet after Brazil. And there are almost as many mammal species in Indonesia as there are, close to as many as there are in the whole of Africa. And then you have here some really iconic local species like the Sumatran tigers, obviously orangutans on both Sumatra and Borneo. And then there's the Komodo dragon, which everybody knows about, which, you know, from tiny islands, actually, next to Flores. I think a lot of people, the wildlife definitely draws a lot of people here. People perhaps decide whether they're going on a cultural trip or a wildlife trip. And as I've traveled around more, I've kind of come to the conclusion that it's a mistake to separate those two things, because once you get to wildlife areas and you spend time in local communities, or even you know, you go to another level with your guide and ask about the traditions and the beliefs and even the herbal medicine, the traditional medicines and things in the jungle, you start to get such fascinating stories with them. You know, the Komodo dragons, for example, and there, I don't know if, as far as I know, David Attenborough, when he went there, he didn't actually visit the villages, or at least he didn't feature the villages there, but they must have been there then. And there are incredible villages in Komodo and Rincha Island that very few tourists take time to visit, and yet they're actually besieged by dragons, and they have all of these traditions and these beliefs. And a commonly held story is, for example, that they were rebels on the island of Sumbawa who were exiled onto Komodo and Rincha by a sultan there who naturally assumed that they would just be eaten by the dragons, and yet they've survived there and they've made a home there, albeit a tentative and a fairly risky one. You know, and there are so many of those traditions, and I've just been up in the Mahakam River where there are similar stories, different but similar, about the white Irrawaddy dolphins, and you have the orangutans and their relationship with the Iban people. It's very interesting as you travel around and you ask, you find the Indonesian link, the local communities link with their animals. At the same time, you know, deforestation and logging and mining are still problems, and it's sometimes quite heartbreaking to travel to jungle areas and realize that you have to pass through vast expanses, entire hillsides of oil palms before you can actually get to them. There's a lot of wilderness and a lot of wildlife still here, but as rich as those statistics are, I think there must be a lot of species that people aren't even aware of yet. Species are still being discovered here and presumably are disappearing at a rate that we'll never catch up with as well.
You know, I want to ask you kind of one more question, and that's going to bring things, I guess, to the really, really present day. I mean, obviously, with COVID, it's been hard to travel around. It's been hard to experience some of these places. I think, and as far as I travel around, I think even internally, even within countries as large as Indonesia, I guess, you know, what's been your experience with traveling in Indonesia during COVID, and now that things are reopening, what are you excited to get back to?
Good question. It's been a real privilege that I spent the first year of the pandemic lockdown in Bali, which was not so bad. I live some of the time in West Bali with my wife there. And then the second part, lockdown in South Africa, just managing to arrive in South Africa with enough time to get hammered by the South African variant. So it was kind of a double heavy lockdown once we got there. But anyway, it's good to be back in Indonesia now. And I think I've been so inspired now to be able to travel around Kalimantan. And I had previously traveled mostly in West Kalimantan, which I knew to be, let's not necessarily say unexplored area, but it gets very few tourists. I knew that it's kind of the least traveled part of Kalimantan, which is the Indonesian side of Borneo. And now I've traveled a lot around the country, and I realize that it's, you know, I've actually seen 10 tourists in the last 6 weeks, or 10 Western tourists in the last 6 weeks of traveling. There's so much to see here. And that goes for so many of Indonesia's, even the main islands, never mind the little ones. Sulawesi is the same. Sulawesi has a draw card with the rich culture of the Toraja people kind of in the middle there. But the island, if you take a road trip from one corner to the other, it's like 1,700 kilometers long. So there's so much to see here. I mean, I think I could travel in Indonesia for another lifetime and still not see everything. Probably the commonest question I get is, as a travel writer, and I've been doing this job for more than 25 years now, people usually say, what's your favorite country? And I don't have a huge concentration span, so I like to be able to switch around and get to Africa sometimes or whatever. But I usually cheat and just say, look, if I had to travel in one country for the rest of my life, I would probably pick Indonesia because I feel like I could travel here and, you know, never see the same place twice. And I could just, you could roam in Indonesia for several lifetimes and it would still be exciting and you'd still be coming across so many new places and wonderful people everywhere you go. There's kind of, I don't feel like there's any question of a security problem here. There's a natural code of hospitality so that you genuinely feel welcome everywhere you go.
So I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Mark Evely, author of Kopi Dulu, Caffeine-Fueled Travels Through Indonesia. Mark, I do actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? And what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
So the best place to, my books are all on www.markevely.com. That's the best place to look, but they're also up on Amazon. That's the best place for Kopi Dulu. Next thing on the headline for me is to finish off this Borneo book. And I also have a novel coming out in probably in February, a novel based in West Bali in the little village community that I live in West Bali. So I guess I need to keep silent about that for the time being, but maybe we can have a chat about that next time.
Yes. I look forward to hearing more about both those books closer to release. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's N-I-C-K-R-I-G-O-R-D-O-N. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. This podcast is on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for more info who's coming up on the show. But before then, Mark, thank you so much for coming on today and talking about Kopi Dulu.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been great to have a chance to catch up and have a chat. Thank you.